Can we talk something else? Can we talk about something else?
Hello. Out there. I've spent my life largely ignoring devious behavior. It's not something I've done consciously, but today's story made me realize that I've always suffered underhanded and sneaky tactics from devious people as a way to avoid having to accept the truth of them and have a confrontation. And I don't mind confrontation, that's not really the problem. I just know that the confrontation of or exposure of a devious person, one who believes they're smarter than and able to fool those around them, that's dangerous to confront them. They're like a bomb that needs defusing. And if you get a wire across while trying to exit from their purposes safely, they'll likely explode. If it's business, they'll undermine your work performance. If it's personal, they'll try to humiliate you with what you've shared in confidence. If it's pleasure, God help you. Because a devious person out to get their rocks off will throw rocks when you turn to run. They will beat you to the ground and take what they've convinced themselves is theirs, what they're owed. And why do you owe them anything? What would give them that idea? Well, you made the mistake of being nice to a devious person. You made the mistake of letting them get too close. You made the mistake of hoping they weren't what you eventually knew they were. Deceitful, devious, no good. You ignored their darkness. And it snuffed out your light. Welcome to Dark Topic, I'm your host, Jack Luna. This is a true crime happening. The Seventh Shadow. August 2nd, 1982. Bob and Jackie Johnson, a happily married couple in their early 40s, are, along with their two little girls, excited to get the family vacation started. Their eldest daughter, 13-year-old Janet, who is preparing to enter grade 8, is a pretty, athletic, blonde-haired young lady with a genuine love for nature. Her younger sister, 11-year-old Karen, is much the same as Janet, though quieter and brown-haired. She's looking forward to grade 6 as this final adventure of summer, a camping trip with mom, dad, grandma, grandpa, and her big sis, gets underway. The Johnson family's plan is to pack up their beige 79 Plymouth, a storage container strapped to the roof, and head out to Wells Gray Provincial Park, a destination about 3 hours north of their community of West Bank, BC, in the Okanagan Valley region. British Columbia is beautiful just about everywhere you look. One could throw a dart at BC and land somewhere desirable. Of course, that dart might land on the forehead of a homeless drug addict, which in itself kind of has its unique charm, I suppose. You can't really go wrong in BC, especially back in the time of this case, the early 80s. The Johnsons are leaving one desirable place, their small community in West Kelowna, for a spectacular area that is Wells Gray Provincial Park. Life is good. Mom and Dad love each other. The girls are so innocent, happy, and not yet bothered by angst. These are Janet and Karen's twilight years of childhood. Mother Jackie is well aware. She's packed her camera and has recently taken on photography as a hobby. This trip will be well documented. When they get to the remote campsite, a place known by locals as the Old Prison Site, by map as Bear Creek, they'll soon be joined by Grandma and Grandpa Bentley. And they were Mother Jackie's parents, George and Edith Bentley, traveling in their brand new red and silver Ford pickup truck with a Vanguard camper attached, complete with a 10-foot aluminum boat strapped to the top, boat motor secured to the back of the camper, spare tire wrapped in a leather case sporting the red Canadian maple leaf on the front. She's a beauty. The Bentleys have been resistant to give up tent camping and roughing it as they'd done together for 50 years, but age had finally caught up to them. This new camper was their pride and joy, trumped only by time spent with their grandkids. Their son-in-law Bob has the tents up, the makings of a fire built for cooking up fish soon to be caught. Bob's favorite beer, extra old stock, cools in the creek. He has a stubby in hand when Jackie's parents arrive. It will be hiking, berry picking, fishing, and cooking over the open flame. This was a very loving family who enjoyed spending time together whenever possible. Photos of the group shine with love. They have an ease about them. They're usually in the middle of an activity together when the pics are snapped by Jackie. Every smile is broad. They stand close to one another, but not in a staged way. Often on these trips, especially in the movies, there's an underlying stress present, as family excursions often have a forced feel. But this group genuinely enjoyed being together, and their family photos more than support that claim. The father, Bob, was no strung-out Chevy Chase character trying to hold it all together. He's known as a joker by his friends at the town mill he works at back at West Bank, so he does, you know, screw around a bit, but his nature is to spread happiness and laughter around. His daughters likely haven't seen a gloomy or dark day in their lives to this point. And Bob, who in many photos has the brim of his hat flipped up and a cold one dangling casually from one work-worn hand, is enjoying his time off immensely. He deserves it. He occasionally pops a cool bottle slip from Phage Creek that runs by the remote campsite. His mother-in-law warms a pot of beans over the fire. His kids prepare sticks for spearing hot dogs with Grandpa. Unfortunately, fate has been stockpiling that absence of conflict and stress the girls have only known to this point in their short lives, and it's ready to unleash in a torrent upon the unsuspecting group in the form of a boogeyman who observes the happy clan of six. From the shadows, the seventh shadow, as he'll come to be known, grabs at himself as way to acknowledge and appease the unstoppable lust growing for the young blonde girl. The wolf-like man, long, lean, muscled, mustache over thin lips, hairy head cocked like an animal's as his beady eyes and pockmarked face glimmer in the not-so-distant glow of this family's firelight. David Shearing watches the girls head off to their tent eventually, and the routine of the family completes itself. He then returns to his mother's house through a long trail in the woods. He'll be back. Those six shadows aren't going anywhere fast. The fun has just begun. Wells Gray is a provincial park which at that time had just over 100 campsites available, spread out a considerable distance to ensure privacy. This wasn't a trailer park in the woods style setup that many of us are accustomed to. The idea here was to actually get out into nature and get away from it all. Families went in and weren't heard from unless they drove into the small town of Clearwater for supplies or a payphone. If anything were to happen to an individual, or in this case a group out there, chances were nobody would know of it until they were expected home. The week of this August 82 camping trip for the group of six passed, and Bob, who had never been absent or even late to work at the lumber mill, didn't show up for his first day back in mid-August following that vacation. The rest of the family went unmissed as they had no obligations, but the absence of Bob provoked an instant concern amongst his co-workers, who knew the man very well and were convinced that even if he'd had car trouble, he would have found a way to contact his boss. For further context, I should point out that Bob Johnson had once cut a finger off at the lumber mill and returned to work the next day. Friends of the man knew that Bob's in-laws, the Bentleys, had joined Bob's wife and two young daughters on their vacation. They were to arrive in their brand new camper, something Bob Johnson had been keen to check out. Car trouble now seemed entirely unlikely, seeing as how the group had two vehicles available. After a week without word from any member of the family, their hometown banded together and started doing what they could. Some accompanied police along the roads on the 3-hour trip from West Bank, much longer than 3 hours when stopping and searching every town along the way. A large group took that trip out to Wells Gray Park in search of the family. Missing posters were spread across towns to spread awareness in this time, the wonderful, goofy early 80s where word of mouth was still the most potent form of social networking. Once in the Wells Gray Park area, police began questioning locals as volunteers searched the massive national park without any luck. School begins, and the Johnson sisters aren't present. An impending sense of doom begins to pervade Western Canada. Finally, after 3 weeks of absolutely nothing, authorities are handed their first break. Mushroom pickers discover a burned-out vehicle deep in the woods. It proves to be the Johnson 79 Plymouth. It has a hue to it like a mushroom, incredibly. This orangish, burnt-looking hue. The Plymouth is checked out, and its license plates are still intact. Investigators are quickly able to determine that it's the missing Johnson's vehicle. The car has been thoroughly torched, but investigators manage to retrieve teeth, skulls, and bone fragments from the ashes, and are able to determine that four adult bodies have been placed, then burned in the back seat. One of the skulls eventually has a bullet retrieved from it, confirming that the four most likely have been murdered before being set alight. The head of an axe is recovered. Nearby, some fallen trees have been broken down and dragged away to make room for the Plymouth to be pushed into the bush. It's obvious that someone has put in great effort to hide the vehicle. They've even made an attempt here to avoid a forest fire, it seems. An officer pries the trunk open, though the keys are in the trunk. They're melted. And he pries it open with a crowbar. This officer is then met with the sight of two skulls, staring emptily out at him. All six bodies have been thoroughly doused with an accelerant in an attempt to evaporate them from existence by a killer who longed to wipe what he'd done to the family from reality. I should mention that it's quickly determined that the bodies in the back seat are all adult. The ones in the trunk, the skeletons are smaller. The skulls, looking up at them, are smaller. The girls are in the trunk. The adults are in the back seat. The two girls in the trunk seem significant. Why would they be kept separate from the rest? What is left of the bodies is collected and placed together in a single small coffin, the type usually reserved for babies, in fact, and a large service is held back in devastated West Kelowna. It's not clear what happened to the family, who simply took a camping trip, like every one of the attending families at the funeral service had done themselves at one time or another. From here on out, each summer would have a taint of sorrow to it for these good people, and every planned vacation would see enthusiasm substituted at times with wariness. Investigators do their work. They canvass, knock on doors, follow every small lead. That late summer, Wells Gray Park fills only 18 of its 105 campsites. People are spooked. A family of six had been erased out there, and it wasn't in any way clear how. Finding the camper is top priority. A park ranger comes forward after recalling having seen a camper that matches the description at a site called Bear Creek. There's a pot at this site that they find matches camping trip photos from the past of the Johnsons. There is beer in the creek, matching the brand that Bob drank. There are shell casings discovered, .22 caliber, same as the bullet pulled from the skull. The discovery of this murder site is kept quiet by investigators. They hold on to whatever they can, with so little to go on. Then a lead comes out of North Battleford, Saskatchewan, after news of the murder sweeps across Canada. Patrons of a diner claim that two rough-looking French-Canadians had stopped in with a camper sporting BC plates. They were loud and obnoxious. Memorable. Composite sketches are made from witness descriptions. One looks like the Wolfman. The other looks like every scumbag from the 80s, blonde, mullet, mustache, wiry. Tips begin pouring in, 1,300 plus, from BC to Quebec. For non-Canadian listeners, that's like San Francisco to Washington, England to Kazakhstan, Australia to Australia. 4,000 kilometers, 2,500 miles. It's a lot of ground to cover, especially while responding to false leads all along the way. Investigators, of course, don't have the advantage that we have of knowing there was a seventh shadow, one that lived a short distance from the discovered murder scene, one that had failed to find Bob's bottles of beer in the creek, or pick up his .22 shells, or stash the girls' marshmallow sticks. This shadow need not worry initially, as investigators along with the entire country now are convinced that the killers are in a stolen camper and they're fleeing east to Quebec. The leads pouring in seem to confirm this. More than 1,300 leads, I must reiterate, that's a lot of leads. This is a case not just bungled by cops, but by a country. Oh, Canada. In all of us command. Indeed, we were in command here. And we commanded the police to chase a phantom camper across Canada with two obnoxious French Canadians in it. A reenactment of the crime is produced and distributed across Canada. For the short documentary Citizens Alert, a camper and truck are purchased that are almost identical to the missing one for the corny reenactment. After the documentary is distributed, investigators decide to put signs on the side of the camper that ask, "Have you seen this vehicle? Johnson Bentley Murders." The camper displays a phone number for tips, of course. And I've got no doubt that a few tips were called in about the camper displaying the phone number to call in tips if you've seen that camper. You know, I saw, I just, I think I just saw it. They drive this across Canada, pulling into towns and talking to locals and media. They distribute missing posters. The tips continue to wash in, raising hopes while drowning any real chance of catching the actual killer. In Windsor, Ontario, a mechanic calls in a tip that he painted a camper for two obnoxious Frenchmen. The mechanic claims they were trying to get rid of a .22 caliber rifle as well. Investigators are justifiably convinced that they're getting closer. Every resource is focused on this cross-country manhunt for the camper and two maniacal French-Canadian werewolves. And this is when a tree-planting crew from Edmonton stumbles across Grandpa Bentley's burnt-out camper and pickup truck back in Wells Gray Park, up on Trophy Mountain, across from Battle Mountain, where the Johnson's car had been found with six corpses reduced to ash within. Initially, the tree planters think nothing of the camper. There had been a forest fire in that area. That's why they've been planting trees. And they had assumed the burnt-out camper to be an old relic of the past blaze. It is found 12 kilometers from where the Johnson family car was discovered. Like the car, it had been well hidden along an abandoned logging road deep in the woods. Whomever had driven the vehicles into the bush had driven them until they became stuck, then set them ablaze. The discovery of the camper back at square one is deeply embarrassing for the investigation. Every tip, hundreds and hundreds of them leading away from the crime scene, have been false. People just wanting to help, they guess, or be a part of something. Either that or two dozen hairy French Canadians were driving campers across Canada that year, being rude and obnoxious. And these are stereotypes of French Canadians, by the way. Hairy, rude, and obnoxious. This tag to every lead on the camper made the tips quite convincing, though I don't know about the hairy part when it comes to French Canadians. They seem to clean up pretty well to go to Parliament and run the country into the ground, am I right? But on the obnoxious and rude part, you could have fooled me. That's all I'm going to say on that. You could have fooled me if you said they were being obnoxious and rude. That sounds about right. The investigation shifts back west. It's been a year wasted, but now they have a solid lead. Because of the location where the camper was dumped, it's obvious that whoever put it there was familiar with the area. There was a canyon nearby, the burnt-out camper, and it looked as though whoever was driving had tried to get it there, but had given up due to getting hung up on some deadfall. It's now October of 1983. This crime took place somewhere between August 10th and the 17th of 1982, I'll remind you. A lot of time has been wasted. And it could have been more if whoever drove that camper out there had gotten into the canyon, they would have never found that. They believe they would have never found that vehicle in that case. They'd still be searching Quebec for these two French Canadians. But now, they have everything, save a suspect. They have the two vehicle sites and the still-secreted crime scene. And these make a triangle. So the distance between the two vehicles was 12 kilometers. I have to wonder if you were to add up the campsite distance from them making that triangle, if the three sides of that triangle would average to around 6 kilometers a side, 666, probably not. But if we can waste a year chasing fat, hairy, phantom Frenchmen, you can give me a moment to work some numbers. David Shearing, a name made of 13 letters, finally comes to the full attention of investigators. This name had come up more than once. A waitress at a Clearwater cafe, Clearwater being the town closest to the secreted crime scene, had slipped a canvasser a note. The note had 13 letters on it. "He's a bad dude," the waitress said. "A real bad dude." And now, as investigators speak to every man, woman, and child in the vicinity of the Bear Creek Triangle, a couple tells police that a friend of theirs, David Shearing, had asked them how to get a bullet hole fixed in the door of a truck he had. He also asked how to register a stolen vehicle. The camper had been found with a .22 caliber sized bullet in its door, a detail not yet released to the public. Shearing is tracked down, and it's found that he'd been living at his parents' ranch that sat in close proximity to the crime scene at Bear Creek campsite when these murders happened. He'd been previously interviewed, but had not raised suspicion. Then the search for the Frenchman had begun and the circus left town. Soon after, Shearing, a wolf-like man that we met briefly as the seventh shadow in the beginning, had moved about 8 hours north of Clearwater to a remote mining town named Tumbler Ridge for work. Shearing had no arrests, though he was suspected in a few crimes. His dad was a jail guard, his brother a sheriff. He came from a good family. After asking around, one of Shearing's acquaintances tells investigators that they believe David was responsible for a fatal hit and run that happened in Wellsgrave Park a couple of years ago, but he hadn't been convicted due to a lack of evidence. A call to the RCMP in Tumbler Ridge is made. Police there are familiar with David Shearing already. He had been busted for stealing $40,000 worth of tools from a couple of trailers, and as a condition of his release, he was required to check in once a week. The sheriff in Tumbler Ridge is instructed to not spook Shearing. They tell him to let Shearing know he's wanted to clear up some details of the hit-and-run case, that he's not under arrest, but to come with the sheriff to the nearest legit police station in Dawson's Creek. Shearing agrees to come. He sits up front of the police vehicle. He's uncuffed for the long drive. They want to spring their questions on him. They want to give him as little time as possible to think and prepare. So the guy who's driving with him, the sheriff, he just talks about regular stuff and acts like this is kind of a pain in the ass for him too. I should add that in passing, they have a conversation about hunting. And David Shearing shares that he's not a hunter, his father's not a hunter, but they do have weapons for protection against bears and wolves out there. And his father has a Remington 22 pump action that he likes to use himself when walking around out in the woods for protection. Once at the station, Shearing is led into an interrogation room where they do speak about the past hit and run case for half an hour. This was an instance where Shearing had likely been drunk and hit a teenager with his truck, killing him. There's little information on that incident, but I believe Shearing claimed to have not noticed that he hit a poor soul walking along a woodline road at night. He'll later admit to this when it doesn't matter anymore because he's admitted to so much by that time. Detective Eastham watches Shearing closely as he begins to shift to the Bear Creek murders. Shearing is visibly relieved to this point that the subject has stayed on that past incident, and he's casually smoking with the lead investigator, Eastham, who coined the nickname of the Seventh Shadow, by the way. And Eastham, he casually begins talking about the murders because they happen so close to his family's ranch. Shearing stays nonchalant and in passing reveals that he's aware that those murders happen around the old prison site. That would be Bear Creek to out-of-towners. This, as I've mentioned, is a detail not released. The exact location of the crime scene, where Bob Johnson's favorite beer, Extra Old Stock, was found in the form of a few stubbies, forever waiting on him, cooling in the creek. Detective Eastham pounces. He's desperate for a confession. Shearing, who is chain-smoking now, gets squeezed by Eastham, who is certain this is the guy. He lets Shearing know that they have him. He knows he tried to fix the bullet hole in the camper. He has the bullet found in a skull, and that bullet no doubt will match one of his dad's guns. Detective Eastham leans heavily on the fact that the crime scene was unknown to anyone outside the investigation. Shearing is clearly guilty. The way he's behaving reeks of it to Eastham. Detective Eastham asks him if he knew they were going to eventually find him. Shearing breaks down at this and whispers, "Yeah." Then he says, quote,
"Just give me your fucking gun and leave me alone with it for a few minutes. I'll take care of everything."
David Shearing admits to the murders. He seems relieved, but the tale he tells doesn't ring true to Officer Eastham. There's parts clearly missing. And before Eastham lets him off the hook, accepting the confession that amounts to 6 charges of second-degree murder, Detective Eastham makes Shearing promise to tell him the truth about what happened once his trial is complete. The two have bonded over countless coffees and cigarettes. The detective knows that the Seventh Shadow is too slick to give it all away now, but he might just relish an opportunity to be good to his word with a man like Eastham, an all-Canadian type who has a big brother-like effect on Shearing. Shearing nods and shakes the detective's hard hand.
"It's a deal."
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
This is the quick load of bullshit Shearing laid on the confession table. We will get to the true story a little later here. David Shearing claimed that it was a robbery gone wrong, He'd spotted the family camping on his way to work, saw the new camper, and decided to rob them of it. Late at night, he crept up on them, quickly lost control when Jackie noticed him creeping through the brush. Bob lunged at him. He shot Bob, then had to get rid of the rest. He piled them into the car and burned it. Once he realized he wouldn't be able to get rid of the camper without drawing suspicion, he torched that too. What he fails to explain is why the girls were in the trunk, and why he decided to kill and rob the family of six just to burn the spoils immediately afterwards. He also glosses over the horror which had to have occurred when he drove the six dead out to the woods. He didn't have room for all six in the car, so he put a couple in the trunk. All right, and we guess that makes sense. But doesn't it seem odd that the smallest bodies went in the trunk? There's something about that, like they were saved for last. And I mentioned earlier that Bob's keys were found melted into the trunk. The killer had left them dangling back there, as if he'd taken one last look at the girls before torching the thing. No, wait, I suppose he'd have opened the trunk to douse them in gasoline, so perhaps that's why. You see, you start to see it all a little clearer the more you allow yourself to think on it. This is one of those stories that you don't want to think about at all once you read about it in the newspaper. Shearing said it was night by the time he got home. Remember, he dumped both vehicles within walking distance of his parents' ranch. He drove them as deep into the woods as he could in either direction. First up Battle Mountain with Plymouth full of bodies. Next, the camper up Trophy Mountain to the canyon he failed to reach. God, he'd wanted that camper. She really was a beauty. Save the bullet hole he'd put in the side while gunning down Grandpa. He'd been going for his gun, you know. Grandpa Bentley had. That should be known. And it can't be said enough how heroic they all acted as soon as that shadow came out. But again, that camper had been hard to give up for Shearing. It was a real beauty. And investigators gotta be wondering what else had been hard to give up. What else had been a beauty there, David? You got a thing for little girls, Shearing.
No. Just shiny new trucks and campers.
All right. Well, I guess that's it then. You know, I wonder how long the fire lit up the woods for him as he moseyed away, smoking cigarettes. I wonder how he managed to avoid starting a forest fire. I read that he may have cleared some trees to get the vehicles deeper in the brush. I mentioned it before, but I wonder if some of that was to avoid alarming anybody with a forest fire or excessive smoke. I read that Detective Eastman said that hauling six bodies into a car would be a lot of work. He himself had to lift a dead body, and one was enough. Shearing was a big, strong wolf of a man, though. The interrogation yields a confession. That's all they care about. Detective Eastman knows there's more to it, but they take what Shearing is willing to offer on the record. He hopes to secure the rest with a handshake. Shearing, in the end, at least admits he did it. He killed them all with his father's pump-action 22 Remington. He was drinking, and he made a bad decision.
Take me away.
David Shearing pleads guilty to all six counts of second-degree murder. At the trial, the victim impact statements cause him to turn his back to the gallery. On April 16, 1984... almost 2 years since the mass killing, Shearing is sentenced to life without the possibility of parole for 25 years. The six counts of second-degree murder were to be served concurrently, at the same time. Six rolled into one, kind of like what had to be done with the six family members poured into one coffin. It has been explained to me that the reason places like Canada seem to be so easy on their worst criminals is in part because they want the prisoners motivated to behave. The thought is that if they feel there's hope, then they'll be easier to manage, which I kind of get. I do. That makes some sense to me. But here's what I find hard to swallow. It's the perks they get. Shearing, in the time since his sentencing little over four decades ago, has been allowed to change his last name to Ennis, his mother's maiden name. This was obviously a way for him to hide from what he'd done, a manipulation of history so he'd be harder to find in the future. He married some poor soul named Heather and is allowed conjugal visits. Heather loses her job as a result and whines about that not being fair. And nobody stuck up for Heather, of course. I'd say marrying a man capable of gunning down a family of six, including two little girls, would expose some kind of character flaw. Wouldn't you, as her employer? She displayed poor judgment. So her employer, candor. And tough shit. At least that was the sentiment back in the 80s, when the real world still existed. Shearing picked up a trade in furniture refurbishment. That was in preparation for what could have been his release in 2008, when he would not yet have been 50 years old. Fortunately, he didn't complete the required courses in his time. I guess one of those included How to Stop Murdering People for Their Stuff 101, from what he had shared to that point. Recently, Ennis tried to get parole, and a petition with 90,000 signatures helped to deny him that parole. The killer has taken the rehab courses. David was a big drinker and blamed that some. He also admitted to being a stalker of sorts. He also has since admitted to some sexual deviancy, which we'll get to, and he wants to get all that fixed. His next mandatory parole hearing is in 2026, but he can apply for supervised release any time between. The system is designed to release him. It's only a matter of time before he finds an opening. This keeps the family diligent, connected to the case, controlled by the whim of Shearing, or Ennis. Ennis the Menace. Anyways, I've fallen into a tone where it seems I'm wrapping up, but we need to properly unravel this first, and we will right now, thanks to the work of retired RCMP Sergeant Michael Eastham and author Ian McLeod. Their book on this case, The Seventh Shadow, revealed as much of the truth as could be learned after Shearing, incredibly, kept his word to Detective Eastham. David Shearing had returned to the old prison site the following night of his recon mission. This time he had a gun, his father's pump action 22. The main target was not the camper, though it would be nice if he could figure out how to keep it. The target was the taller shadow of the two who'd just gone off to sleep in their tent. The blonde one. He wanted Janet Johnson, JJ, as she was known by friends. Friends she looked forward to seeing again in grade 8, following what had been such a wonderful summer, capped now by this camping trip with her parents, her grandparents, and her little sister Karen, surely not too big yet at 11 to avoid a chance to cuddle, as the sisters breathe deep the night air and drift off to sleep in their tent. The sounds of the grandparents, their parents conversing, in the background. They are soon awoken by the screams of their mother. Jackie Johnson had spotted Shearing creeping up behind the camper. She got up, then her husband Bob saw what she saw and rushed towards the long shadow that raised its weapon before shooting the man in the throat. Bob hits the ground gurgling, and all hell breaks loose. Mother Jackie runs screaming for the tent her girls are in, and she's gunned down. Next, Shearing turns to the grandfather, who is going for the camper and his own weapon. Grandpa Bentley goes down, and the camper itself takes a bullet in the process. Grandma Bentley is the third to die as she hobbles away screaming. The sight is so desolate that nobody can hear her. Nobody except the girls, Shearing, and Bob, who still struggles in the firelight, gasping for air, fighting to stay alive and do something about this before he's finished off by Shearing, shot in the head. Shearing takes a moment to compose himself. He maybe licks a hand and slides it through his greasy hair before entering the tent with the girls. First, he tells them to stay calm and stay in the tent. Shearing claims that he's just run off a gang of hoods that had attempted to rob their family. The girls, so innocent, ask if it was bikers. Yeah, Shearing admits, it was bikers. But you're safe now. Just stay here while I make sure they're gone. This is Shearing's story, told in confidence to Detective Eastham following his sentencing. Some details are no doubt missing, others finessed to make him sound less repugnant. Shearing says he drags the bodies into Bob's Plymouth. He piles them into the back seat and covers them with a blanket. Detective Eastham notes that this must have been hard work. Shearing agrees. It also must have been bloody work, David. You had to have been covered in blood by the time you got back to the tent. Shearing doesn't want to talk about that. Back in the tent, he gets to the real issue at hand here. He orders the girls to strip. They begin to cry, and Shearing smacks them around a bit. He'll claim that they were begging and they were ruining the mood, so he had to get them out of the tent and head to the car with him. He says not much happened in the tent. Shearing has the keys, and he drives the girls with their dead parents and grandparents just behind them out to a desolate wooded area near his parents' ranch. This area is so remote that even if the girls tried to escape, they'd likely become lost. Besides, Shearing tells them there's bears and wolves out there, so don't bother. He'll be back. Shearing claims that the girls thought their loved ones had gone for help, and that Shearing was their hero. He leaves them for extended periods in the car with those dead loved ones. This while he moves the camper out to a hiding place, takes a shower, and gets some rest. He leaves them without food or water for at least 24 hours at one point. The story is scrambled, it makes little sense, but if this is what he's giving up, the idea of two girls in a car with four dead bodies, alone for long periods without sustenance, if this is supposed to be not that bad, then what's bad? Well, we know he took them to an old fishing shack of his family's. He made the girls walk a long distance to get there, in their pajamas. He shares that Janet, JJ, as he came to know her, was a virgin and didn't know how to do sex stuff. He raped these girls out in that shack. He had his way with them for days. It was for a week, actually, in squalid conditions. They must have been so miserable, scared, hungry, cold, terrorized, when the knock came at the cabin door and Shearing told them to be quiet. Shearing hid the girls behind the cabin door as he spoke to the prison official, who was out there supervising a couple of low-risk inmates on a fishing trip. The killer managed to charm away the armed official, then closed the door to the cabin and enveloped his victims once again. That night he took them back to the car hidden at the ranch. After this long journey, he brought Karen out to the woods, then returned a short while later without her. Janet asked where her little sister was. Shearing cracked a beer and told her he tied her up to a tree. Ah, see, I've missed something. The girls, they were chained throughout. I just realized I forgot to mention that. That's how he kept them in the car when he went to eat or sleep, to make that make more sense for you. He kept JJ, as he called her, as she'd shared with him was her nickname. He kept JJ as long as he could. Later, the initials DS for David Shearing and JJ for Janet Johnson would be found scrawled in that fishing cabin, a detail that didn't make the trial, one Shearing kept to himself. He saw her as his girlfriend, DS and JJ, sitting by the trees. He finishes his beer, then tells Janet it's time to join her sister. He walks her out to where he needs her to be. Then, like he'd done with poor Karen, he tells Janet to turn around. He has to take a leak. Then he retrieves the rifle from behind a tree and executes the girl. David Shearing drags both bodies back to the Plymouth, which must reek of death by now, and puts the girls in the trunk. He drives out to Battle Mountain, drives as far as he can until the vehicle becomes stuck, and the rest, like the Plymouth soon was to Shearing, is up in flames behind us already. Unfortunately, Shearing, or David Ennis, as he prefers you know him, is not yet burning himself. He's working on getting right with God, and on getting a second chance at freedom. In the beginning, I spoke of devious people, and their ability to get close to good people, their way of manipulating you until you're not sure which way is up, before taking you down. Those initials in that cabin, something most evil, captured something most innocent, and completely ruined it. It ruined beyond comprehension to get there. Let's not forget that. But when you speak of deceit, of deviance, of evil, you speak of whatever possessed David Shearing to become the seventh shadow of Bear Creek that August of 82. And the worst of it happened when the sun came up, revealing the shadow to be simply a man. A man most would have told you was a pretty good guy, while others would slip you a piece of paper with 13 letters on it and warn you that that's a bad dude. That's a real bad dude. And that's enough for me, I think. I'll talk at you soon. There's links to the source material I used for this episode. Once you see the face of Shearing, the cut of him, you'll know this was worse than I could ever put across to you. Check out Patreon or Apple Plus for exclusive content. Remember, when you sign up for exclusives, you're supporting Dark Topic, but you're also unlocking a lot of past unreleased content. It's growing. Don't miss out. This episode was actually one that I refurbished, much like David Ennis refurbishes furniture, from the deep, deep past of Dark Topic, probably 7 years ago. It wasn't available anywhere. It was just a lost episode Leroy and myself had done together. So I fixed it up for this episode. But I think it was important to share again and to remind people that this guy's still trying to get out every year. Every 5 years for certain. But every year, I think every week he could apply for unsupervised releases, and that's where it begins. And before you know it, we have no idea where he is. Anyways, like I said, don't miss out on that additional content. If you're looking for more Dark Topic, check out Patreon, check out Apple Plus. There's links. And I'll be there until I'm back here, which I'm working hard to be more often here. I'm sober, save the occasional stubby from the creek. That's where I want to be with my sobriety, just casual. 6-packs instead of 15s. I'm focused. I'm tired of all the bullshit. And I just want to be my best version for my kids, my girl, my family, my friends, for you. That's it. That's all I want. You know, and the pathetic, they make promises while the strong simply show up. That's also where I want to be, so I won't make any. I'll just see you next time. It's important to get there as quick as you can. You never know when something's going to step from the shadows and fuck it all up. You got to control what you can, at the very least. And poor Bob, you know, poor Bob Johnson. God, I always just relate to the father, you know. The whole thing was such a nightmare. But that's what I do here, dream up nightmares. Dredge up. Until next time, keep those eyes cocked, those doors locked, and stay paranoid. Thank you.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.